and it's important for our times.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hey, listeners, please tune in to part two of this interview, or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, The Real Thanksgiving: Truth, Myths, and the Wampanoag Legacy. Thank you to our guest, Paula Peters, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer, and original music by Blakequake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
All My Greatest Teacher Showed Me Love, a new mental health program hosted by Zan, providing tips and tools along with music, interviews to lighten and brighten in these uncertain times. Join the community every first and third Wednesday from 10 to 11 a.m. only on KBOO 90.7.
All you need is love.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is the Progressive Paige Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
To understand how much distortion is caused by the presence of billionaires in our economic system, you have to grasp the difference between $1 million and $1 billion. Think about how you'd feel with $1 million in the bank, or if you live in a high-cost city like Honolulu or New York, imagine how you'd feel with $10 million in the bank. Now imagine you've decided you want to stack up your fortune and then just enjoy the sight. A $1 million stack of perfectly compressed $100 bills would be about 43 inches, or about as tall as most 6 or 7 year olds. A $10 million stack would be a little bit less than 36 feet tall, which is in the ballpark of a three-story home. A $1 billion stack would be over 3,500 feet. There are no buildings that tall anywhere in the world. We have to switch to airplane mode. Imagine looking out the window of a 747. At about 1.2 to 2 minutes after takeoff, it reaches 3,500 feet. A $10 billion stack would be about 35,000 feet, or cruising altitude. A $100 billion stack reaches the edge of outer space. Billionaires don't just use that astronomical amount of money to buy yachts and mansions. In his book, Burned by Billionaires, Chuck Collins lays out the case that their outside influence is ruining our lives and our planet. Chuck, thanks for talking with me.
Hi, Marianne. Thank you for having me.
There's always been a certain amount of inequality in our economic system, but it seems more unequal than ever. What's changed?
Well, you're not imagining it. We have steadily, over the last couple decades, been pulling apart Wages have been stagnant or flat for most workers, and a lot of the wealth, the savings and asset ownership, has flown, not just gone up to the top 1%, but the top of 1/10 of 1%, the super rich. I think there's all kinds of problems in our society and in our personal lives that are connected to that growing inequality.
About how many billionaires are there?
Well, I'm happy you asked. I checked this morning because it continues to increase. This morning, we have 916 billionaires in the United States. There are about 3,000 globally. Their combined wealth is over $8 trillion. And just to sort of show how quickly that's changed, their combined wealth before the pandemic was about $3 trillion. So the richest 800 plus households have seen their wealth go up $5 trillion in about 5 years.
How does that compare to what the average assets a family has?
Yeah, the median family in the United States has about $140,000 in assets. That includes home equity. If you look at the picture, the 93% of the stock market ownership is the richest 10%. And again, within that, it's really the top 1% and 1/10 of 1%. My line is, hey, we could do with fewer billionaires and more thousandaires, meaning there's about 40% of the population that has negative or zero net worth, no cushion to fall back on, one car repair away from going deeper into debt. I think the mark of a good society is when everybody has some cushion. There are more thousandaires and fewer billionaires.
How are the billionaires trashing the planet?
In this book, I try to look at all these different dimensions, all the different ways how it shows up in our daily life. So one is environment, and we're all, you know, kind of waking up to climate change, watching the hurricane hurtling into Jamaica today. We know that climate change supercharges the existing extreme weather events we're living through. And we're all sort of trying to grapple with, well, what's my individual responsibility here? Should I change my behavior in some way? But what I would underscore is the billionaires, the ultra wealthy, are the drivers of climate disruption. They're the super emitters. They have more houses, more flying private jets, which is really one of the most polluting forms of transportation, owning yachts. The average American probably burns about 10 tons of carbon a year in everything we do, including flying and driving and our home. But Larry Ellison, the second richest guy in the United States, can burn about 7,000 tons of carbon just in 1 year riding around in his yacht. And that doesn't include his mansions. I want to, on the one hand, say we all should do our part. On the other hand, if you're making a change and you're paying more to get a more fuel efficient car, or you're trying to live a green life, and somebody's flying their private jet across LA to have lunch with their friend, it kind of makes us all feel like chumps. So that the other concern is it undermines that sense of shared sacrifice and solidarity that we're going to need to pull together to face the disrupted future we're heading into.
That sense of lack of shared sacrifice is also felt in the tax system. Why do I pay more taxes than Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk?
Well, you're certainly paying a higher percent of your income in taxes. And in some cases, some of those wealthy billionaires have figured out pretty much how to opt out of paying taxes entirely or get their effective rate down to just 5 or 6%. This is a longer story, but a lot of us feel our local taxes, property taxes and sales taxes and the like, have gone up a lot. And we're upset about that and feeling squeezed. But what I urge people to do is look upstream and take a historical perspective, which is in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, the wealthy, and then I'm talking about that top 1/10 of 1%, the super rich, they paid way more higher percentage of their income in taxes. The effective tax rate was closer to 50% on the 20 million and up group in the 50s and 60s. And today it's like 15, 18%. And for the people who can invest in hiring lots of financial advisors and wealth advisors to help them play shell games with their money, they can game their taxes down to zero. So you're paying more because the rich are opting out. And they've also lobbied to take taxes off the federal system, which still is more progressive, meaning rich people pay a little bit higher percentage of their income, onto state and local taxes, which are regressive, meaning lower income people, middle income people pay a higher percent of taxes. So shifting taxes off federal onto local, off corporations onto individuals, off of income from wealth, capital gains, and onto wages. You do that for 40 years, and lo and behold, that's where we're at. We have a tax system that's almost voluntary for the very rich, the super rich who hire all those wealth defense advisors, and the rest of us are picking up the bills.
And we had our largest middle class in the 50s and 60s when we had that high tax rate, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And I think that's an important point is in those 30 years after World War II, say 1945 to 1975, we really did have a rising tide lifting all boats, not just the yachts. We had an expanding middle class. We had expansion of home ownership. We had the narrowing of the wealth gap by race and income gap by gender. By the 60s and into the 70s, we were pulling together. We were growing the economy together. And that was a much healthier economy, much greater productivity. Consumption didn't depend on, the rich buying more Rolex watches. It depended on the middle class buying more refrigerators, whatever. It was a more of a equitable, healthy economy. And really since the late 70s, 80s, we've sort of moving in the other direction, pulling apart, becoming much more unequal.
Let's talk about race. How are billionaires supercharging the racial economic inequality?
Well, we do have a persistent racial wealth divide. The home ownership rate, say between whites and blacks, is still a 30% gap. And that's just the legacy of racism over centuries, really, in terms of how it shows up in our bank accounts. The problem is when you have an economy, as we do today, that is more focused on protecting the inherited wealth of the super rich, helping build dynastic wealth, multi-generational wealth, that economy is not good for anyone who's not born rich. Instead of investing in social mobility and opportunity for low and middle income working class folks, middle class folks, we're more focusing on funneling more wealth to the top. And I say we mean, I mean the rules of the economy, tax policy, trade policy, the government's rules. So yeah, what we see in these unequal times is that the racial wealth divide is getting worsened, supercharged by this pulling apart. But it's frankly the same dynamic that's happening to anybody who's not in the born wealthy category.
And one of the places where we see this is the cost of housing and the real estate market. How have the billionaires been influencing that?
Well, there's always been this historic dynamic, gentrification or whatever you call it, just wealthy people bidding up the cost of land and housing or buying multiple homes. But what we're seeing today is whole next level. What we're seeing is wealthy people buying more houses, owning multiple properties, investing in luxury real estate, not as places to live, but as kind of like safe deposit boxes in the sky. Luxury condominiums in most cities, rural land. It basically is the problem of when you have billions of dollars, where do you park it? Where do you invest it? And real estate is very attractive. It's a way to hold value and distribute your holdings over a large geography. So that's the reason why Bill Gates is the largest owner of farmland in the United States. It's not that he wants to be a farmer. It's just that he has so much money, he needs to park it in different places. So we're seeing that in housing. We're also seeing billionaire-backed private equity funds, these investment pools, buying up single-family houses and renting them to people as opposed to selling them. Buying up mobile home parks, buying up apartment buildings and converting them to short-term rental, kicking people out who used to live in affordable apartments. And then you have billionaires from around the world bringing their wealth to the U.S. because we've become a tax haven. We're a desirable destination for the world's billionaire class who want to hide their money. So they're parking that in U.S. assets and U.S. real estate. So you put all those things together and the inequality is supercharging the existing housing crisis that we're living through.
I thought tax havens were places like islands in the Caribbean. How did the U.S. become a tax haven?
It's a great question. It's something that's changed in the last 10 years. What's happened is a number of states have changed their state laws to attract global wealth. South Dakota, Delaware, Wyoming, they've become what I would characterize as tax haven states. Delaware has created the anonymous shell company. South Dakota specializes in a certain kind of trust, anonymous trust, what people call dynasty trusts, where people can park their wealth for generations and not have to reveal the identity of the owners and not have to pay taxes. So the U.S. has become this very attractive tax haven. And you're right, most people think, oh yeah, the British Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands or some little island that has special banking laws. And those still exist. And often there's an interaction. People park their money in Bermuda and then transfer it to a U.S. housing project. So yeah, we have become a destination sometimes for wealth that's been laundered or has been stolen. We're a good place to launder and diversify your wealth holdings if you're a global kleptocrat or a Russian oligarch or whatever.
How does that benefit the states that are passing these laws?
It doesn't benefit them a lot. I think for the 600 people who work in the trust industry in South Dakota, those are probably decent paying jobs, and they can go to the legislature and say, keep tipping the rules and making sure our industry is the favorite industry. But it doesn't increase the tax revenue to the state. It doesn't help ordinary people. It's just a couple of jobs in Rapid City. Not insignificant if you're in Rapid City, but it really doesn't help the vast majority of people who live in these states. It just helps a small segment of the businesses there.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is Chuck Collins, and we're talking about his book, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. We were talking about how the U.S. has become a tax haven. And doesn't that invite a criminal element into the economic system? This seems like it goes against everything that we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and a lot of these don't have transparency. We don't know who's owning. We don't know who's buying up real estate. We see that in a lot of markets now. Anonymous shell companies and limited liability companies incorporated in Delaware are buying up businesses and assets and real estate in our regions and communities. And we don't know who's buying. We don't know who's buying that mobile home park across the street. Could be a group of international investors or could be some subsidiary of Jeff Bezos. We don't know. And that's part of the fix. How do we fix this? Is greater transparency in ownership. We need to know who's buying up our communities.
Or it could be an international drug cartel too.
Yeah, and we see that all the time. Again, the kleptocrats and the money launderers and the illicit drug activity folks, they may be doing illegal activities in their home country, but then they eventually move that money out of their home country. They want to get away from any kind of oversight and enforcement. And where do they bring it? They bring it to the United States of America, and they bring it to one of these tax haven states and set up bank accounts and trusts and park their money and move it around the United States. So yeah, we're part of the global problem. We've tried to reform this. The Treasury Department has tried to crack down on this. Law enforcement says, hey, we can't do our jobs unless we have greater transparency. But the big money lobby always tries to fight those basic reforms and keep the status quo of this shameful system in place.
I interviewed an author of a book about evictions earlier this year, and the rules imposed by these corporate owners are really horrendous. You get one day late on rent and they're going to a judge to evict you. It's very different than when you had a landlord who was down the street and you could say, hey, I'm going to get paid in a week. Can you wait?
We see this in a lot of communities where these big billionaire-backed investor pools, if you will, their whole goal is to earn huge returns for their investors. I don't know about you, but whenever I get my bank statement with my interest earnings, I kind of laugh. You know, if it makes it into double digits, I'm amazed. Well, a lot of these investors are like, how do we get 22% returns? How do we get 30% returns? So how do you do that? Well, you have to, first of all, go into a part of the economy where people don't have a lot of choice whether they're going to pay you or not. Think of emergency room ownership. Or one example is I spent a lot of time working with tenants living in mobile home parks. First thing you learn from talking to people in a mobile home park is their home is not so mobile. Once you've moved into a mobile home park, you're not going to move your home without damaging it or at great expense. And where are you going to move it to? One investor said to me, he said, oh yeah, owning a mobile home park is like owning a Waffle House where the customers are chained to the booths. They don't have anywhere to go. They're just going to have to pay what you charge. And that's exactly what they're doing. And they invest a lot in bill enforcement and billing and putting these trigger laws in there. You miss your payment and you lose your housing. So their focus is extracting huge rents and returns. And they are not very patient when it comes to somebody struggling with an illness who's trying to pay the rent.
And the other place where they literally have people who are chained to the system is prisons.
Yeah, the ultimate captive market is people who are in prison. And we see these private equity funds moving into prison telecommunications. So think about it. People in prison want to talk to their family members. And we know staying connected to family is a key part of how do people move forward in their lives, staying connected to community. But we've discovered them charging exorbitant rates to make phone calls from prison or to use the internet or to use email. At this stage, the investors are predating, if you will, on the experience of the bottom 70% of households. You need housing. You can't afford housing. You're going to get squeezed. You have a health event and you have to go to the hospital. You get squeezed. They're looking for every corner of our pocketbook and wallets to just squeeze a few more nickels out of what we're already paying. That is one of the ways this shows up in our daily lives.
But billionaires give away lots of money to charities and nonprofits. Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, I think generally it's a good thing, but I think we need to step back and say, well, what's happened to philanthropy as these inequalities have grown? And one thing is that it used to be that the nonprofit sector, the charities that we depend on, the Boys and Girls Club or the YMCA or local mental health services or the March of Dimes or the Red Cross, all of those charities were broadly supported with small donations from ordinary working people. And now philanthropy has become more and more the arena of the ultra wealthy, meaning only about 9% of taxpayers now itemize their taxes and take the charitable deduction. And the super wealthy pretty much use it as a way to opt out of taxes entirely. So you're a billionaire and you move your money over to your private family foundation. You get an immediate tax break, a reduction in your taxes, and then that money can sit there for generations with minimal payout requirements or no payout requirements in the case of a donor-advised fund. So yeah, the problem here is that charity and philanthropy have become effectively taxpayer-subsidized arenas of private power and influence. Let me say that more slowly. We subsidize, we taxpayers subsidize the private charity of the rich. About 75 cents of every dollar that a billionaire gives to a charity, we chip in the form of lost tax revenue. They're opting out of taxes and they pretty much get to give it to their pet causes.
Which gets us to probably the biggest impact is in our political system, because it's pretty apparent the elections are now just being bought.
I think the way I would say it is the billionaires have taken your voice and your vote. Vote still matters in certain elections and certain situations, but more and more, money pretty much dominates and has captured our political system, starting obviously with elections and campaigning, who gets to run for office. There's what some people call the wealth primary. You have to run and convince the donor class that you're a credible candidate. And of course, there are great and inspiring examples of candidates who aren't controlled by big money, and we need a lot more of them in this moment. But our political system has been hijacked. Political scientists would basically say, if you're not rich, your impact on the political system is negligible, is near zero. Only if your interests align with the billionaires can something that you support happen. A lot of what the wealthy do is use their wealth and power to block changes, prevent change from happening.
It's a self-reinforcing loop. They get in And then they make sure that no changes are going to pull the money away from them. And then they have more money so that the next round, they have even more money to buy the candidates.
Yeah, I think, Marianne, you're describing the cycle. Call it kind of doom loop. The more wealth concentrates in few hands, the more these people use their wealth and power to rig the rules of the economy to get more wealth and power. And they also use their wealth to extract more wealth from the healthy real economy, or to nickel and dime the rest of us. So that cycle continues. And the solution, obviously, is to reverse that cycle, to get wealthy people, require them to pay their fair share of taxes, make investments in things that create opportunity for non-wealthy people to have good lives. Going back to what you and I have already spoken about, the years after World War II, we know how to create a shared prosperity economy, but it does require breaking up concentrations of wealth and power through taxes and antitrust legislation, and making investments in things that help non-rich people get access to the American dream. That's the program, and we're straying from that in this decade.
And do you see a lot of difference in the two political parties on support for the billionaires?
What we've seen is really over 40 years, bipartisan drift. Inequality's grown under Democrats and Republicans. I would characterize it today that the Republicans are almost entirely captured by the billionaires, and the Democrats are largely captured, but the soul of the Democratic Party is at least in play. You have people like Bernie Sanders, and you have people running for office saying, I want to help create opportunity for everybody, not just the billionaires. Under Joe Biden in 2021, there was a legislation called Build Back Better that would have been a $3.5 trillion investment in things that would have greatly reduced inequality and made for a much more healthy society. It was blocked. Two votes in the Senate, two Democrats got bought off to basically block this incredibly popular legislation that was entirely paid for by increasing taxes on multimillionaires and billionaires. So we came within a whisker of passing legislation that would have greatly reduced inequality and would have started to move us in the right direction, reversing this multi-decade cycle of extreme concentration of wealth. But the powerful rebelled. They said, we can't have this. We need to stop this. We need to buy a president who will reverse all these efforts. And that's what we have right now. But I actually think there are some pretty big cracks right now in the coalition that elected the current president. A lot of people are saying, whoa, wait a second. I live in a rural community where people voted for Trump, but they're like, whoa, wait a second here. I want to return this box to the store. I'm not sure I like what's going on here between the tariffs and the kidnapping of their employees and just the rising cost of living. Everybody said, oh yeah, I care about affordability and the cost of groceries and the cost of eggs. And Trump said, oh yeah, I'm going to fix that problem. And here we are. So I think there are a lot of people who are scratching their heads saying, I don't like this direction. And then the more we talk about this billionaire hijacking of our society, people see it on a very gut level. People know what I'm talking about. They may not know the very specific ways every part of their life is being touched, but they kind of get the sense like, oh yeah, the economy's rigged to benefit the rich, and that's not good for me. And then the question is, who's going to do anything about it? People don't trust the Democrats, but there are people running now in all places around the country saying, yeah, vote for me. I'm going to work for everybody, not the billionaires, not this kind of phony populism where, oh yeah, I'm going to give you a crumb and I'm going to give my billionaire friends the treasury, but really genuinely are going to help non-rich folks have a good life.
In the book, you talk about how this system doesn't even make the billionaires happy because it creates a society that's so unstable.
There is a segment of billionaires who will say, wow, it's not in our selfish interest to keep allowing these inequalities to grow. It creates a polarized society. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for healthy capitalism. Right now you have an economy that's focused on luxury goods, delivering to this richest 1% or the top 10%. Well, that's not a viable, sustainable economy. And if you look at it through the lens of climate disruption, well, there is no planet B, as much as some of these guys like to talk about shooting their rockets to Mars and that sort of thing. There's no viable space colony or other planet or planet B. It's not in anyone's interest to keep pulling apart and polarizing. It's historically, we know it leads to depression, economic breakdown, war, or polarization. It's not the kind of society any of us want to live in, including rich people.
But it seems like there's a different psychology with billionaires. You were talking about how they were looking for greater and greater returns. And is there a point where you just say, you have everything, stop it?
People up to 30 million, they have great lives and they're living in a bubble and they're protected. But once you cross 30 million, you're no longer just buying a jet or another house, you're buying a senator or a media outlet.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Chuck Collins, and we've been talking about his book, Burned by Billionaires. Chuck, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
In to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by the Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest